You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
What I'm really concerned about, though, is could we legally retrieve our embryos?
There's mostly concern. There's worry. There's some anger.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
What I'm really concerned about, though, is could we legally retrieve our embryos?
There's mostly concern. There's worry. There's some anger. As patients and physicians want to be able to make these decisions together collaboratively and not have these decisions made for us and without our input.
Doctors and IVF patients are caught up in a mixture of emotions and a lot of confusion after the Alabama Supreme Court's unprecedented decision that frozen embryos are children. The decision means doctors like Mamie McLean could now face criminal charges or punitive damages if they discard unused frozen embryos, which is a normal part of the IV process.
This ruling is so incomplete, and it leaves those of us who are sitting face-to-face with patients just with the inability to comment on what is safe and what is legal for them right now.
Alabama's largest hospital and several fertility clinics are pausing in vitro fertilization treatments because of legal concerns. And patients like Matt Clary and his wife are in limbo. They'd planned to go through another round of IVF this summer, but are now unsure whether it will be available.
Nobody has the answers of how do you navigate this.
Joining me is healthcare attorney Harry Nelson of Nelson Hardiman. Harry, the Alabama Supreme Court is the first court to rule that frozen embryos are children, citing anti-abortion language in Alabama's constitution. But the facts of this case are rather odd.
It appears that this decision was the result of a very calculated case. The case involved two families who had had children through a fertility center and had additional embryos stored at the center. Those embryos were destroyed in a bizarre incident where another patient apparently walked into an unauthorized area, opened a freezer, pulled out the storage container with the embryos, suffered immediate freezer burn, and dropped the container, resulting in the destruction. And so it doesn't seem obvious, at least to me, that the natural response of someone who had hoped to use an embryo for future in vitro fertilization would be, you know, to sue for wrongful death of a minor. Right. Yeah, certainly people would be aggrieved, but it certainly seems there's a calculated decision to bring a case under this law and challenge the destruction, to use this incident to test whether the loss of an embryo in this manner could somehow be considered the same as the death of a child. So that was the legal theory they went forward on, and they lost in the lower court. And then the Alabama Supreme Court surprised most people by agreeing with the theory that the parent who lost these embryos alleged, or that their lawyers alleged, which was that the accidental destruction of the embryos in an embryo lab in a fertility center was the legal equivalent of killing their children. That an embryo being stored in this lab, a fertilized embryo, which according to the testimony was the equivalent of a few days old into the pregnancy process, but less than a week, that was the same as a fully born child who had been killed. You know, it's an extreme position. And it raises all kinds of troubling implications for anybody who is involved at all in the process of extracting, storing, implanting embryos, handling them in any way. The simple meaning of this case is that you are potentially, if anything happens to these embryos, you are effectively committing the equivalent of a homicide or a manslaughter of a child.
The common practice with a patient undergoing IVF, multiple embryos are created, right? So that the patient can try again if an attempt at pregnancy fails. So what kind of problem does a decision like this create?
Right. You know, it's a difficult procedure in which there's no certainty that a single embryo will implant. In fact, if you go back just 20 years ago, prior to the Octomom case, it was common practice for many fertility doctors to implant significantly larger numbers of embryos to see which ones would succeed. And it's still a common practice to implant smaller numbers of multiple embryos, which is one of the reasons we see a lot more twins resulting from IVF. The problem now is that based on this case, the handling of those embryos is effectively the handling of live children, I don't know, between the age of one-day-old newborn to 17-year-olds, those embryos have the same legal status as those children. And these are embryos that are in the hands of labs, doctors, hospitals, surgery centers, and really a world of new questions of what their responsibilities are. Like, what happens if the power goes off and there's a disruption that way? What happens if they aren't used and they're simply sitting there? Is there any consequence if they're no longer usable? What happens if there's a dispute between the parents? What is their status? They are no longer property. They are live, right? So this is a radical new legal world that we've entered with this decision.
Usually, the parents have the right to decide what happens to embryos that are not used.
Correct. Until now, and in every other state, embryos are effectively property. The parents have full discretion over what to do with them. Parents can decide if they don't want to pursue further IVF and there were remaining embryos, they could simply demand that they be destroyed, and they would be destroyed like any other kind of tissue in a lab, right? And it's not that they would have zero value, but they would not have the value accorded under Alabama law to a life, and they would not be facing the dire consequences of having essentially taken a life by the negligence of allowing a patient, a third party, to get into the facility. So all kinds of really scary implications about what this new status means.
Also, can you do genetic testing on embryos then?
The question of whether you can do genetic testing or what you can do to these embryos short of destroying them is a really interesting question. There's nothing in this decision that suggests that you couldn't do genetic testing. However, anytime that you have any kind of contact with, you know, embryonic tissue, you are effectively potentially taking a risk, right? There is a risk that the extraction, even though it's often done safely, I think doctors will routinely tell patients there is a chance that this will result in destruction. So I think genetic testing just became, in this context, became basically off limits in Alabama because it could result in the destruction of the tissue and therefore essentially a killing.
And this is a decision where the court hands down this radical decision and then just says, okay, we're done. And the implications are left to, I don't know, the medical profession, patients, the legislature. Who decides?
Yeah, this decision in many ways reminds me, it sort of parallels the Dobbs decision itself, which repealed Roe v. Wade, in the sense that the Supreme Court said, we're issuing this proclamation that Roe went too far and we're kicking it back to the states to decide. And there was this almost like assumption that the problem would just sort itself out at the state level. And in fact, we've gotten a result of national chaos over the last nearly 2 years. And this decision does exactly the same thing in this smaller context of IVF in Alabama and embryos, because it's created a world of chaos where all these different actors, parents who are considering IVF, and fertility treatment, fertility doctors, hospitals, health systems, medical school training programs, storage companies, everybody's got to make these new decisions. And there will certainly be new regulations, but there's a lot of personal decisions just to sort of avoid this whole uncertain, chaotic environment in favor of going to states where this is totally uncontroversial territory.
Harry, some doctors are saying that patients because of this, could have to endure longer and more costly treatments to try to achieve a pregnancy if they're only allowed to create one embryo per cycle. And one cycle of IVF now costs about $15,000 to $25,000. Tell us a little about the process.
The process, if you speak to any woman who's had it or couples that have gone through this, it's quite an intensive process to prepare for it, for the extraction of the eggs, and then essentially the fertilization of the sperm and egg happens in the lab. And then once there's confirmed fertilization and just a little bit of growth of the embryo, it is then implanted. And, you know, there's a question of whether the woman's uterus will accept the tissue and whether it will attach appropriately. And then there continue to be questions, and a risk of unsuccessful implantation or miscarriage is a very significant risk. This is an amazing miracle of reproductive health technology that's advanced fertility in recent decades that's made this a possibility. But I personally know multiple couples that have had to go through round after round of this procedure, and that was with implanting multiple embryos just to get to successful pregnancy. And so basically, this has eliminated the possibility of more than one embryo being implanted, and it means that the odds of each treatment, of each IVF attempt, are now reduced if you do it in Alabama, where you certainly can't do more than one embryo, and it's become higher risk. I suppose most fertility doctors would probably do two and allow for the possibility of twins if that's acceptable to the mother, but you're really still really narrowing the chances of a successful implantation and a successful pregnancy delivered to term. So it's very likely that women will have to do this more. And that also is compounded by the fact that in addition to being difficult and emotionally stressful, it's extremely expensive. And very few people have the resources to repeat this process over and over again without significant financial backing.
As we said, the ruling is only valid in Alabama, but at least 11 states have broadly defined personhood as beginning at fertilization in their state laws. So can we expect the anti-abortion movement to start pushing decisions like this in other states?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the logic of the decision here is something that the Right to Life movement is supportive of, which is sort of treating embryos with more sanctity in all of these states and eliminating practices that have bothered them for a long time, right? Like I said, we already in the last 15 years, certain practices in fertility have already gone away under pressure, including the practice of implanting multiple embryos and then doing a reduction to remove embryos to get to the right number. It would not be surprising to see the law in all of these states, and it is a logical implication of saying that life begins at conception. I mean, it would require some different articulation that would potentially, you know, devalue what's occurring at conception or immediately after to say otherwise. So I think this position is going to be supported by the pro-life community, and I think the rest of us are going to have to figure out how to deal with it.
Would you say this is a new chapter in the continuing fight over women's reproductive rights?
Yeah, I do think this is, in a sense, a new chapter. I don't think people should be surprised, right? I think that we've seen the implications already post the repeal of Roe v. Wade with regard to not just abortion, but with regard to miscarriage treatment and seeing it extended into fertility. This is something that was absolutely predicted right after the repeal. It's not surprising. People should not be surprised to see contraception be the next battlefield. And these questions all are really going to push at what most of us have accepted as the traditional, you know, right around reproduction, reproductive health access that women had and that all of us had. None of it should surprise anybody who was thinking through the implications when this repeal happened.
And there are sure to be more ripple effects of the Supreme Court overturning Roe. Thanks so much, Harry. That's Harry Nelson of Nelson Hardiman. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Every day between now and November, the American people are going to know that the only reason the border is not secure is Donald Trump and his MAGA Republican friends.
And it seems like President Joe Biden is trying to keep that promise of showing up Trump and Republicans who killed the bipartisan border deal by making some changes of his own. The Biden administration is considering taking unilateral executive action, using provisions of federal immigration law repeatedly tapped by former President Donald Trump to enact a crackdown at the southern border. According to Bloomberg sources, the administration has been exploring options that Biden could deploy on his own without congressional approval. But it's far from clear that the measures could withstand almost certain court challenges. Here to tell us about them is Leon Fresco, a partner at Holland & Knight. He was the former head of the Office of Civil Immigration Litigation in the Obama administration. So, Leon, tell us what measures Biden is considering.
President Biden is considering a number of options, which some of them have been tried in the past and some have been rejected in the past because of questions about their legality. But let me take you through them. So the most important in terms of impact would be trying to take what is normally known as the travel ban statute, which is INA Section 212F, and actually saying that it can be used to remove people whose bodies have already entered the United States without letting them apply for asylum. Trump tried this, and the reason it didn't work is because the 212F travel ban statute uses this very interesting word in the immigration law, entry into the United States. But the problem is, under millions of cases that exist in immigration law and, you know, all the way up to the Supreme Court, this word entry means preventing the actual body from entering the United States. But once you've entered, then what's needed is a deportation. And so what the travel ban statute prevents is an entry, but the entry here has already occurred. And so the question is, can you use this travel ban statute to deport someone without going through the normal deportation process? And that's going to be ultimately a question for the courts, but most likely is that's not going to be allowed because that wasn't allowed under the Trump administration, even though that specific question didn't work its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. That is one of the things that they're discussing. But the question is how likely it will be to succeed. So that's number one.
Let me just stop you a minute. So in that case, they would take migrants who enter the country and immediately deport them?
Right. Their argument would be employing INA 212F, the ban on entry statute, to say that even though you've entered, we're not going to let you enter because you've entered illegally. So entry means legal entry. And so we're banning any kind of illegal entry. And so once we find you, we're allowed to kick you out without giving asylum, without any due process of any kind, any look to see about asylum or any trafficking or anything else. That's not going to be our concern. We're just going to take you and move you right back into Mexico without any of that. And so the question will be, does this ability that the statute gives to prevent an entry work after an entry has already been made in a case where the entry made was illegal? And so that's going to be the question that a court will have to determine.
I'm sure that that definition of entry doesn't meet the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition, but legal interpretation is another thing. But it sounds like that wouldn't pass legal scrutiny when it's challenged, which it surely will be.
It may also be that the Biden administration doesn't care if that gets enjoined, because at least from their perspective, they can say, look, we tried. Do you now see that this takes Congress? Congress, now back to you.
The Biden administration is also discussing ways to make it harder for migrants to pass the initial screening for asylum seekers, essentially raising the standard. Tell us about that.
The standard right now is called credible fear. And what that says under the law is, do you have a significant possibility of having an asylum case that's plausible? And the issue is that there is some dicta in the court. This is not binding law, but it's pretty strong dicta, that even for an asylum case, you have to show that you have a 10% chance of being persecuted in your home country. So this credible fear standard is, do you have a significant possibility of having a 10% chance? And so it's a pretty lenient standard. And so what that means is a lot of people can qualify. Now, if you raise the standard, many people believe Congress is the one that needs to do that, because every single time that the government has tried to raise the standard, whether they do it on paper or whether they do it verbally, they kind of give a hint in to the agents, look, start finding ways to deny these claims. The advocates figure it out, they sue, and they enjoin whatever new move was done, because the law is actually pretty firm that it's this specific credible fear standard that must be applied at the moment until such time as Congress changes it.
All right, that makes two that seem unlikely to withstand court challenges. What else are they discussing?
So then the next few possibilities are the sort of more acne, tried and true, always they try to do this and they never work resolutions, like, for instance, moving to a last-in, first-out processing system, which what they say is, okay, let's just clear the deck of the millions of cases that we have for deportation, which is making things take many months. Let's just immediately put someone who comes tomorrow into court, so that way at least these new cases are moving quickly and we can get them processed. But what happens is that never works, because the person then says, I haven't found the lawyer yet, and there's case law about giving people a chance to find the lawyer, and so you have to give them several weeks to do that. And then once you've done that, then you've already moved from this urgent processing point and we're back to square one again. So that issue of can we clear the deck and move cases quickly has, unfortunately, unless we're going to start assigning people lawyers so that then they have to make their asylum case on the spot, that would be a way you could move people through the courts quickly. But I don't think Congress has given enough funding to make that succeed in any grand scale. And I think people would be against that on the conservative side, because they would say, why are you giving free lawyers to the foreign nationals coming illegally? But the problem is if you don't do that, there's all this case law that says you have to give people a reasonable time period to find a lawyer, which then subverts this ability to have a rocket docket, essentially.
And they're also considering detaining more people?
The problem is there, one, you need additional congressional funding to do it, which ICE is now saying they actually can have less money to be able to detain people. And number two, you can't detain anyone where there's a kid involved. So you couldn't detain families coming together, and you can't detain children at all. And so you would just be detaining single adults, which the government is already doing at the capacity they're doing. The problem is many, many more people coming than the detention spaces that exist. Now, maybe you can start using military bases and other things of this nature. And so that one can be done, but it's going to need more funding to convince people you really are serious about detaining people.
Does Biden have the resources for any of these plans to be implemented?
So for the ban, he certainly does, because the ban doesn't cost anything. The question is, will the courts uphold the ban? For the increased detention, he's going to need additional funding from Congress for things like, food for the people that are being detained, housing, transportation to move them to these detention facilities, things of that nature. So all of that will be needed. The question is, will Congress give them that funding? Or what the Biden administration could do theoretically is divert resources from other Department of Homeland Security priorities to this. But the question is, how much money is there really in the budget to divert to this that's not being used for something useful? I mean, surely there will be some programs you could divert to this, but I don't know in terms of the billions that will be needed that there's billions left to divert. So that's why you would think that Congress would need to pass the funds for that.
It sounds like all of these plans might have a problem in the courts.
Correct. And I think that's where the question ultimately comes down to. Is the Biden administration proposing these changes to simply have them lose because it knows that they will lose, but at least they can say, look, we tried, and now isn't it obvious that Congress needs to act? That's one option. Or option two, are they doing it to just say they did something at the end of the day? I mean, that's ultimately the question. It's not clear what the goal is, but if the goal is that they think that there's something they can do at the moment that doesn't have some congressional assistance that's going to completely stem the tide of what's happening at the border, it's going to be very, very difficult to accomplish because they're going to need at least assistance from the court. Maybe they don't need assistance from Congress, but they're going to at least need assistance from the courts to do something that the courts have never permitted before.
So a Bloomberg News Morning Consult poll last month found that 6 in 10 swing state voters say Biden bears at least some of the responsibility for a surge in migrants. The border and migrants are going to be a prominent issue in the 2024 elections. And, you know, we've seen Democratic mayors and governors and some lawmakers asking Biden to do something about the migrant crisis. Do you think that will outweigh what we expect may be outrage from, you know, the far left and from immigration advocates?
I think it will depend during the spring how intense the crossings are. If the crossings are at the 3 million per year rate that we've been seeing very recently, it's going to be very difficult, the impact that this is going to have on cities. And this is where I think the Biden administration would at least do itself some good in terms of trying to go to the Congress and say, look, if we're going to do something, we need to at least have detention. You need to at least give us the money to do one specific thing, which is detain single adults who don't have anywhere to go and are dependent on cities to house. That probably needs to end as soon as possible. Now, do they need more money to do that? Probably. I don't think there's the money now in the budget to do this on a massive scale. But I do think if Republicans were to reject that, or if Democrats or whoever were to reject that, then that would look like a very bad faith effort. I mean, you could talk about all these changes in the law that some people liked or didn't like or whatever. But if the issue is just, hey, what do you want us to do with people if it's not to detain them while their case is processing? You tell us what you want us to do. And so that's the case. Now, you could say, well, what I want you to do is do remain in Mexico. But the problem is there, that infrastructure, you know, to the extent that people want to blame Joe Biden for something, was torn down completely at the beginning of the Biden administration. And then Mexico took legal measures to make it impossible in Mexico for that to ever be done again, meaning Mexico had acquiesced. Now there are Supreme Court decisions in Mexico that prohibit this. And there's laws in Mexico that prohibit this. And so what would need to happen is that whole process that started under the Trump administration would need to be restarted, where Mexico is threatened again. Hey, your days of building cars in Mexico are over. We're going to give it a 50% tariff if you don't help us with remain in Mexico. And then Mexico would have to change all its laws again and go back to the Supreme Court and figure out some way where that would be allowed to be changed again and do all of that. And the point is, the Biden administration needs a solution in a month. They don't need a solution in 6 months or a year. So that's the problem with sort of having taken down that infrastructure, is that infrastructure cannot be built so quickly to reinstitute remain in Mexico.
Okay, thanks so much, Leon. We'll see what Biden decides to do, if anything. That's Leon Fresco, a partner at Holland & Knight. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Some of the biggest names in corporate America have kicked off the year with large layoffs. Companies announced plans to cut 82,307 positions last month, up 136% from December, and the second most of any in January since the aftermath of the financial crisis. That's according to Challenger, Gray & Christmas. So how should companies and executives prepare for large-scale layoffs while following employment laws and avoiding litigation? Here to tell us is Rebecca Bernhard, a partner at Dorsey & Whitney. Let's start with a big one. Tell us about the WARN Act.
So the WARN Act, which actually stands for the Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act, believe it or not, is basically a law on the federal level that applies to employers with more than 100 employees if they are going to be doing what's called a mass layoff or a plant closure. And then there's, of course, statutory and regulatory definitions of what those terms mean. But in a nutshell, if you have more than 100 employees and you're going to lay off at least 50 in one single location, then the WARN Act is triggered, which is you're giving notice not just to the employees, although that's a huge component and that's what most people think about, but you're also giving notice to a variety of government agencies. The original philosophy there was that those government agencies would rally and get the unemployment people on standby and get any workforce training resources that they have on standby and that kind of thing. So once that applies, it means you have to give 60 days advance notice, both to the group of employees who are affected, their union, and to this variety of state authorities, starting with like the mayor of the local community and then the Department of Labor's representative in that area, that kind of thing.
Do the government officials that you have to give notice to, are they able to do anything?
In theory, they don't do anything other than rally their own resources. They don't actually engage with the employer to negotiate over who's being laid off or what's being done with, for example, severance packages or anything like that. The reason I mention that is because there are a couple exceptions to the WARN Act in terms of when you can give notice. And a lot of companies like to rely on these exceptions, but I say it's, you know, you should be cautious because the unforeseen circumstances or the faltering business exceptions and the unforeseen circumstances was a big one during the pandemic, of course. They still require you to give notice, and they definitely require you to give notice to government. It's just that you might not have to give 60-day notice. You have to give notice as soon as possible. And so a lot of employers will say, oh, we're a faltering company, or there were unforeseen circumstances, and so they'll lay the people off that same day with no notice. And then they forget to give the government their notice because they think we're not following the WARN Act's 60-day notice requirement. And then they're in trouble with the government for not issuing those government notices. And that involves fines.
I mean, often you hear about layoffs. You know, they're laying off this many people and they're laying them off right then. They don't give, you know, 2 months notice to the employees. Is that because they're looking at an exception?
It could be. And it certainly was fairly common in, again, in the pandemic. Now, I mean, I obviously can't speak to every individual circumstance, and it's possible that they're looking at exceptions, but a lot of companies do what I call prepay the penalty. So if you fail on the employee side, the penalty or the remedy, if you will, would be that the employee is entitled to basically their salary and continued benefits for the period in which the notice was deficient. So in your example, if I'm told today that I'm being laid off, I didn't get my 60-day notice, so I'm entitled to 60 days of pay and benefits. And so a lot of times employers will say, sorry, Rebecca, we're laying you off today. Here's a severance package that includes at least 60 days notice and at least 60 days of all your continued benefits. Sign this release. And they're hoping basically that that will satisfy their obligations as it relates to the individual employees. They don't want to give the notice, so they just essentially prepay the damages of the potential litigation if it ensues.
What happens if you have union members in your workforce? What should employers do?
Yeah. Well, this is a great question because the first thing you should do is pull out your collective bargaining agreement, your contract with the union, because there might be language in there and you don't want to be in a position of not following what you've already agreed upon with the union, which you could have agreed upon decades ago, right? A lot of union relationships are, you know, decades old and current managers don't remember all of the what I'll call boilerplate that's in a collective bargaining agreement because they never have to use it, right? But generally speaking, if there's language in the collective bargaining agreement that says you have to bargain with the union before you implement layoffs, then that's what you have to do, right? You have to sit down. You have to say, we're in trouble. we need to reduce, you know, our workforce, and we're here to talk to you about what your ideas are for that, right? Most general labor law says that unless there is specific language like that, you don't have to bargain with the union, what I'll call in advance, over the decision, but you do have to bargain over what's called the effects. And that's called effects bargaining. And so you have to say to the union, we are going to lay people off. We're going to lay, you know, 100 people off from these two plants. And we're here to bargain with you over, you know, the effects of that layoff. And generally speaking, that's, you know, as you would expect, severance. But sometimes unions want contributions to pension funds over money. And sometimes they might want retraining money, you know, to help their employees get jobs somewhere else. So, you know, that's the theory. They have the right to sort of decide what kind of severance they want. Now, it's possible that the contract itself already contains some severance language. It usually contains seniority clauses, which give you some guide of if you are laying people off, here's the order in which you have to do it. Those kinds of things have to be followed, or else you're going to get in trouble with kind of union litigation. So you want to follow anything that's already in the contract, and then you want to sit down and bargain over anything that hasn't been decided about the layoff process.
If there is no language in the contract, in the union contract, do unions have any power to stop a layoff?
So, of course, the current NLRB is very employee-friendly. You know, it is unclear how cases might evolve. But in general, the case law that kind of Supreme Court made has bubbled up, and it's pretty old. It's, you know, cases from the 70s and 80s. It says basically what I just said, which is you don't get to bargain over the decision of whether or not there's layoffs. But that doesn't mean that a union can't try, right? A union could say, we understand you want to do layoffs. We'd like to talk to you because we have an alternative suggestion. We'd rather go to part-time schedules, or we'd rather, you know, move some work from point A to point B. They are certainly free to request negotiation. They, of course, have all of the economic tools that they would have in any bargaining situation, which, as we understand them, are strikes. Of course, that would be ironic to go on a strike regarding a layoff, but that is, you know, the biggest weapon that a union has, is to sort of put that economic pressure. I think that the United Auto Workers, what I'll call rolling job actions that happened, you know, a couple months ago.
Yeah.
Those were an interesting creative strategy, and you could see how that would work in a layoff pressure campaign, right? If I want to lay off, if I want to, you know, close my plant in, you know, Detroit, Michigan, my workers in, you know, Marion, Indiana might say, oh, well, we're going to strike. And it's like, no, I like that plan. I want that plan to be operational, right? And that might put pressure on me as the employer to sit down with the union to figure out what we're going to do about Detroit.
So now there's always a question of, you know, Title VII, anti-discrimination laws. What are the concerns that employers have to think about there?
That is the biggest kind of area that I think employer side and employment lawyers are kind of engaged to deal with. It's the selection. Who, right? In the union context, we've got what I said already. We've got this kind of seniority concept that helps you select, and that kind of insulates an employer in that world. But in the non-union environment, it's really up to the employer to decide who I'm picking, right? And human nature is going to be such that I want to pick the people I think are the worst performers, or I want to pick the people that I don't like. I'm a human being. I have emotions. And so, of course, anytime you're making those kinds of decisions, you want to make sure that you can defend those on objective criteria and not subjective criteria, because subjective criteria would make it easier for the affected employees to proceed with discrimination suits. You know, you might say that you picked the people with the lowest review scores, but it just happens that you picked all of the, you know, the people of color. And we think that, you know, your statement that it was the lowest performance scores is actually pretext, and you were just trying to get rid of the people of color in the plant. And so the selection of who gets picked for the layoff would trigger any of the protected statuses under the state or federal laws, Title VII, as you noted, but the Age Discrimination Act, and then any local laws that mirror those. And then, of course, disability, too.
So layoffs. I've seen people laid off, and then they get something from the company. Here's who we laid off. So we laid off 20 people above the age of 50, mm-hmm. and then we kept 20 people above the age of 50. I mean, do they try to balance it out that way?
So that is an obligation to provide what that's called a disclosure statement under the regulations for the Age Discrimination Act's amendment of the Older Workers Benefit Protection Act. So the Older Workers Benefit Protection Act amended the Age Discrimination Act and said, if you're going to lay people off and you're going to give them a release of claims to sign in connection with the severance package, and it's a group, you know, termination, you need to give them information about everybody who was laid off and their ages. You can do it by job title. You don't have to do it by name. And that way, those older people can take it to an attorney if they wish. And there's an easy way to visually say, are they really picking on all the old people? And if you know your history, this came out of the movement in the 80s, which of course is where the Warren Act came out of too. There was a lot of plant closures in the 80s, and a lot of companies just picked all the older workers because they were the more expensive. It saved them money on their pensions, and all these folks got laid off, and then they didn't realize they were losing their pensions in the process. So the Warren Act came up to sort of help on that end, and then the Older Worker Benefit Protection Act was kind of a sort of individual remedial amendment to help people get more information about who's being selected and who's not to decide, is there really an age discrimination? So interestingly enough, you had mentioned Title VII before. That doesn't require that same kind of disclosure on whether it's men versus women or Lutherans versus Catholics. So, you know, or all the other protected statuses, you know, white versus non-white. And so employers do, I think, try to do that assessment and that analysis across the board, but they only have to actually share those numbers with the affected employees vis-a-vis age. And I do think they try to balance it out. If employers bring lawyers like me into the mix and we look at that statement before it gets, you know, finalized, we think, geez, it looks like you've got 60 people being laid off and 55 of them are old, right? Uh-huh. How are you picking your people, right? That looks pretty pernicious. And then we would work on sort of the selection criteria and say, you know, are you sure that these are the right 60 people?
Are there any general rules you would give employers when they're thinking about layoffs?
Yeah, I think that all of these different anti-discrimination laws and warning requirements are counterintuitive to the way people tend to make their actual business decisions. And so I just encourage people to try to slow down and contact counsel, either in-house counsel if you've got it or external employment counsel, just to help reframe the decision making. You know, no one wants to question your business. No lawyer, no good lawyer should question your legitimate business needs to take the steps you need to take. But by slowing down and sort of helping think about what does the law say you have to think about, I think you can still make the business decisions you need, but you can sort of be aware of the legal framework that might constrain some of those business decisions or require you to think about, you know, a selection criteria that's more objective, for example. And the after effects and costs, right? If we don't give notice, what are the risks of being sued for notice pay in the first place? And so is it actually cheaper to give that notice and let those people work? You know, that kind of thing.
A lot for employers to think about. Thanks so much, Rebecca. That's Rebecca Bernhardt of Dorsey & Whitney. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.